Welcome to Left, Right and Centre. I'm Vishnu Shom. On the programme tonight, the CFO of the Adani Group takes all the tough questions on their foreign investors, their antecedents, allegations of being opaque, and accounts for the spectacular rise of Adani stocks even in a pandemic year. Will these questions, will his answers really respond to several key queries which have been raised on one of India's largest groups, which has grown at a phenomenal rate? Also on the show tonight, Twitter has lost its legal protection in India from prosecution over users' posts because of its failure to comply with new digital rules. Government sources said today a case was filed in UP against the social media giant over tweets that the police say attempted to incite communal trouble. Certain journalists were also targeted in this FIR. What does this mean for this platform used by millions in our country? And finally, Dr. N.K. Arora, chairperson of the COVID-19 working group, tells us that statistically relevant data involving thousands of cases at CMC Vellore during the Delta outbreak indicates that a single dose of Covishield generates 61% efficacy, while two doses are at 65%. This, the government believes, is justification to keep the gap between doses to where it is presently. A day after a bloodbath on Monday at the markets, where the shares of the Adani Group fell as much as 25%, amidst reports that the National Securities Depository Limited had frozen the accounts of three foreign portfolio investors, there has been a partial recovery after a strong clarification from the company. But there continued to be pressure on these stocks even today. Now, the Adani Group, for its part, has said that the accounts of these foreign investors remain active, contrary to what has been reported. But key questions continue to be asked about the structure of the company, the nature of its investors, and allegations of opacity in its dealings. Joining us now to clarify all of this, and all of this has been reported in many, many places, a very special guest, Jugeshinder Singh, the Chief Financial Officer of the Adani Group. Thanks very much, Mr. Singh, for agreeing to talk and to take these questions, because there are quite a few of them. Firstly, did the Adani Group know that the NSDL site showed accounts of three foreign portfolios being frozen on the 31st of May? Were you aware of this at all?
This was part of a wider action that SEBI had taken all the way back in 2016. And the said FPIs, as far as we were aware, were active in the stocks, have been active for the last many years. So we sought a clarification post the news article, and we were informed that there is no such restriction, and that was related to accounts that are not used for equity trading purposes. And beyond that, it's a more question relevant for FPI, but that's what we clarified, and that's what I clarified in subsequent comments, and the group and portfolio companies have clarified subsequently via stock exchange announcement that it was patently a false report.
But were you aware that there was an element of these your foreign investors listed in the NSDL which was frozen? It may not have been relevant to the operations of the companies, but there was something associated with them which had been frozen. Were you aware of this fact on the 31st of May?
Generally speaking, yes. This has been a couple of years notification. So we were generally aware, but it's not something to do with our businesses or our verticals. So we don't specifically pay. It's not an area of interest to us. Our area of our interest is how the regulators are looking at our companies that are listed on the stock exchange, and there were no such specific restrictions or regulatory notice to us. So therefore, it's not something that I can meaningfully comment on. Although, as interested parties in terms of what it can possibly do to minority interest, we want to make sure that we bat for our minority shareholders, and that up to that point we have interest, but beyond that it's a matter for those FPIs.
Okay. Now, the Economic Times says that confusion over your stocks, and I quote, underscored a deeper risk for investors in such stocks owned by opaque entities. Now, that's also a key concern which has been raised. There are allegations over a lack of transparency over the three Mauritius-based funds that have a huge stake in your group. So specifically the question is Adani aware of the antecedents of its key foreign portfolios?
I think that's for the, again, you know, it's a question which is for the regulatory authorities to look at. The central point that you raise, Vishnu, is the issue that you highlight out of economic times. I think we genuinely, as community and as business leaders, have to be careful of the words we use. That kind of tabloid commentary in a leading financial daily is not appropriate, because first thing is that we a lot of our securities of the said companies, Adani Green Energy, Adani Transmission, Adani Ports, are registered as 144A Reg S securities.
Yes.
Our transparency certificates, we look at a simple certificate of reporting, which we report every 6 months. It runs into well over 20 pages. It is one of the most comprehensive disclosure certificates of any company in the country.
Right.
I'm happy to have any one of our verticals measured against any entity listed in India, on any stock exchange in India, against transparency and disclosure.
Right.
So this is a clear via you to your audience, a clear that if somebody can say that our disclosures are even remotely different or in quality from any entity listed on the stock exchange, I will get it rectified immediately, but it won't be the case.
Got it. So therefore, when I asked you whether you are aware of the antecedents of the three foreign portfolio investors in question, can I say yes, entirely? I mean, you know about the background of these companies which have invested so heavily in the Adanis.
We are aware to the fact that they are investors with us. We don't specifically go and check, because it's not a KYC that we check the KYC of anybody who invests. That is done separately by a separate regulatory body. These entities have been investors in our incubation company, Adani Enterprise, way back since well before 2010. Yes. And what has happened is, Vishnu, is that since 2010, in 2015, we demerged APSEZ from AEL. So these entities got their proportion of shares. Then we demerged APL. Then we demerged Adani Transmission, Adani Green Energy, and then Adani Total Gas. So as the demergers happened, all shareholders of Adani Enterprise kept getting the proportion of shares, because these are vertical demergers.
Yes.
And therefore, it's not that there's new investments have come in or anything like that. It's purely that they were one-time investors who, due to the virtue of vertical demergers, continue to be investors. And other point to note here is that, like any investor said, what we want to look at is the underlying business performances. See, the central question in all of this comes that somehow there is a set of investor or entities or values. Here, the core aspect is on the performances of underlying businesses. So if you just indulge me for 1 minute, look at Adani Ports. Annual growth rate over double digits and market leader. So I would just simply say this. You take India's best IT company, India's best FMCG company, India's best bank, and you put Adani Port or Adani Green or Adani Transmission alongside them. Look at our growth rate. Look at the growth rate of market.
It's phenomenal. And you know, we'll talk about that in a little while, but I just want to get these key issues dealt, sort of sorted out, because it's also come out yesterday politically with the Congress alleging that that these three funds, which apparently have the same registered address in Port Louis in Mauritius, they apparently have no websites of their own. And they are demanding, in other words, the Congress is demanding that SEBI and NSDL come out with a complete disclosure about the nature of these funds and the ultimate beneficial ownership of these funds and the findings of the inquiry. They need to be made public, etc., etc. So do these three Adani portfolios actually share the same Mauritius address? It goes back to that same question. Do you know about the antecedents of these companies?
No, we know the investors, and we have the same public information as that Congress has. And for us, any regulator can look at this. You know, we are not the regulators. The regulators can look at it. We have no problems. And incidentally, just on the Congress point, you know, Vishnu, we operate our portfolio, our verticals operate across just over 330 locations in the country. And you'll be surprised to know that our biggest and single largest exposure by value and business is in Rajasthan.
Right.
And Rajasthan, as we don't have to tell viewers, Rajasthan is a Congress-led government. So we have a bigger one. Our biggest business is in Congress state. Our second biggest business
question. So I'm not sure there's anything wrong with them asking questions.
Exactly. So it's not like, you know,
they would stop asking questions because of your investment in Rajasthan.
No, absolutely. But I think they should ask, they should question. And the question is that, you know, we operate everywhere. So the regulator should question, not, you know, we are not the regulators.
Okay. Fair enough. So that brings me to my, you know, and you've partly answered this question. Should SEBI and NSDL disclose the nature of these funds? Would you welcome NSDL, for example, coming out with more on this since it's been raised?
Regulator should do what regulators have to do for market transparency. We are all for market transparency. Okay. 100%.
Now, CNBC says that earlier these accounts of Cresta Fund, Albula Fund and APMS had been frozen on account of non-compliance with SEBI norms. Have these funds followed the beneficial ownership criteria under the Prevention of Money Laundering Act? Because that requires these FPIs to submit details. For example, I'm told, personal information of key employees, disclosure of common ownership. So while, you know, this all remains active and that's been clear, were these details not shared earlier, which resulted in that block, which you mentioned took place a few years back?
Vishnu, I'm sorry, I'm not aware of that. I'm not aware of the operations of these FPIs at all, and they're dealing with the regulators. And it's just, so anything that I comment would be commenting outside my remit. What I can confirm to you is that for us, the transparency, disclosure, and reporting in a timely manner that we are required to report under regulation, or we are required to report under our own governance standards, we do. Beyond that, I can't really comment on how the FPIs deal with the regulator based on the rules and regulations that they are supposed to comply with. This question is valid for them rather than for me.
I understand that, but it is important, isn't it? Again, in the name of transparency, these are groups with a huge exposure in the Adani companies. They contribute a great deal to your companies, the value of the companies. Therefore, would you not want them to be absolutely clean as far as following SEBI guidelines are concerned?
Yeah, absolutely, 100%.
Okay.
That's not even a question. I mean, we of course welcome anything which will improve the transparency of the market.
Okay. Now, the ET quotes Hemindra Hazari, who is an independent research analyst in Mumbai, who says, and I quote, "The names of the funds are not very well known in the capital market, and they have a high concentration in a select number of stocks, which in itself is unusual. Also, again, and I quote, such concentrated positions, along with negligible onshore ownership, create an asymmetric risk reward, as large investors conspicuously avoid Adani." Now, this is from the Bloomberg intelligence analyst, is what they've said. So my question is a high concentration of foreign portfolio investors into very select stocks unusual?
No, I think whoever is writing this, I don't know the journalist or the researcher. They've never obviously have heard of Berkshire Hathaway. Berkshire Hathaway's $270 billion portfolio, concentrated in 5 stocks. And I think these kind of desktop-ish analysis ignore one of the world's leading investors who is concentrated in 5 stocks of $270 billion. Concentration, you know, as Warren Buffett has said, concentration, if you know what is good, you stick to it. But putting that aside, to say that we do not have, you know, Adani Total Gas, we are 37.4%. Strategic investor Total is 37.4%. Funds like BlackRock, etc., are another 4-5%. So 42% of that stock is held by strategic and global brand names.
Okay.
So this is again a patently, you know, just a basic research for 30 seconds will prove this wrong, this kind of commentary. Then if you look at Adani Green Energy, Adani Green Energy, 24.4%. approximately of the stock is held by strategic and global funds, which includes Total, includes BlackRock, includes California Shipping, and Adani transmission is moving towards that. It's now currently 2.4% held by the global funds. So it will keep rising. And because these are young companies, 2 to 3 year old companies, once we are also 5-10 year old company, these will keep rising. APSEZ again, widely held. It is our oldest companies, widely held. All of that will follow the pattern. Now we are expected to somehow instantaneously behave as if we are a 10, 30, 40 year old company. Our group is 25, a young group. We are growing fast. We grow fast. That's fine. But we also have a unique situation where we ourselves, the family, we ourselves are long-term intergenerational investor. So right. We will always have concentration because we ourselves are not seller of our equity. So we are investing for intergenerational wealth creation in the core sectors of India. So for us, that will always be the case that we will always have one or two or three key investors who will be a big part of our register, but it will diversify like Adani Ports have diversified.
Okay. Now the Ken says, quoting an unnamed analyst, and I quote, "There's not a single well-known domestic institution with a large stake in many of these stocks." How would you respond to that?
Hey, that's an interesting question. You know, it's one of the things that we look at it. Firstly, it's broadly not simple way. The shares are rising in these companies. That statement itself is false. The second aspect of this is that India itself, Vishnu, does not have a utilities index. We are a utility platform. So the question, more important question is, we ourselves are not utility players. So actually, this is such a moot point and is close to our hearts, those who value India and India's growth and India's development. Think of it this way. We at Adani own the core infrastructure of India, just around 65 to 70% of the core infrastructure. What would be the ideal situation? Indian pension funds owning Indian infrastructure or foreign funds owning? In our case, foreign infra funds and foreign strategic investors hold Indian infrastructure. Our preference as Indian homegrown, purely domestic infra and real asset platform, world's top 10 real asset platform, our core focus is the participation of Indian investors in Indian infrastructure. Okay. And that is it's a blight on overall that core in Indian investor set, pensioners and long-term investors are missing on long-term assets. Right. And foreign investors are looking at the long-term right. assets in India and investing in India.
Is that problematic for you, that there isn't a well-known domestic institution with a large stake in many of these stocks?
No, that doesn't bother us at all. We ourselves are a large investor, so a specific institution doesn't add any credibility to anything at all. What's important for us mm-hmm. is a diversified register, which we have delivered on APSEZ, and we will deliver on all of our other companies as those companies mature, without a doubt.
Just a few more questions. Now, from aggressively scaling up your presence in ports and airports, do you see City Gas Distribution as being perhaps core to your success in India? For example, you've reportedly bagged licenses for nearly one-fifth of 136 geographical areas, and I'm told going forward, you'd be bidding for many more. Is this the future of Adani? I know your other businesses, but I'm asking specifically about City Gas Distribution.
City Gas will be a very important element because it's a B2C element, and also it is integral to longer-term environmental transition from liquid fuels to piped gas, and from cylinders to piped gas, which is environmentally friendly, and it plays into the health as well of smaller and regional and C category towns. So we are very much focused in this area. It is one of the key growth areas for us, and it makes India future ready for renewable and sustainable sources of power and energy.
One final question, and I think we've got general viewers watching this who have heard about the stratospheric rise of Adani stocks and the companies themselves. What accounts for this incredible rise of Adani stocks in a pandemic year?
Two things. Number one, the vision and the strategic execution capability of our vertical leaderships and the underlying growth in the businesses. For example, our port businesses are growing at double digit. Our transmission business is growing at double digits. Our green business actually is growing at multiple. It has grown 50x in size. Our Adani Gas business, as you just mentioned, Adani Total Gas, is growing at well over double-digit rates. And second element in this growth and business, because the businesses are growing fast, is that we are the only infra and real asset platform. And this goes back to your transparency question as well, which is credit rating, credit quality is same as the government of India.
Yes.
And that is global, huh? So global transparency standard says that Adani Infra Platform, APSEZ in transport, transmission, Adani Green and soon other company are same credit quality as Government of India. And that goes to the heart of the transparency question. If we were not transparent, no question. We are, in that sense, one of the most transparent, well-disclosed group out there for global investors. Now, if for buyers, for other purposes, the domestic set is in a certain way, it's okay. It's our obligation to inform, our obligation to disclose, my obligation, team's obligation, everyone's obligation. We will do that. And we will deliver a well-diversified, high-performing, world's top infra and real asset platform, which we are already in top 10, and we will be a world-class infra and real asset platform. First time in Indian business history that an infra platform has risen from India to the top 10 in the world. And we are proud of it. We are proud of our teams, and we will continue to do that. And that also spells good news for Indian GDP, because we are Indian GDP story. We don't do anything. We are domestic, homegrown, and that's why we are growing, because India's growth story is solid.
You know, for years and years, the Adani Group faced so many concerns in Australia about your mining project over there, one of the largest in the world, the Carmichael project. You won legal cases over there. You've got the backing of provincial governments, et cetera, et cetera. But is that still a core part of your growth plans, the idea to bring back cheap coal from Australia, possibly to countries like India, to help fuel our growth in this country? Because simultaneously, you are pursuing fuels which are non-polluting. So I'm just trying to understand how important a part of your plans is your mining activity in Australia.
See, the mining activity versus fuel. So mining is a very small element of our overall portfolio, about 6 or 7%. So in our portfolio, so it's not a big element of our portfolio. In relation to fuel, there are two elements to this. One is fuel security element for the country. So it is very important for India, because we are growing fast, we are a large economy, to have fuel security that comes from friendly countries like Australia. So one is the strategic fuel security, so that helps. Second is that the coal mine itself is less than 3% for us. So it's not a massive element of our business. Like, for example, one of our green transaction, which is $3.5 billion SoftBank transaction that we just recently completed in Adani Green Energy. That exceeds our capex in the mining business. Just one transaction. So it is more strategic in nature, cleaner fuel, and providing strategic fuel security for our energy needs. And that's critical for growing economy like India, where we are net importer of energy.
All right, Mr. Singh, lots of questions there. You've taken all of them. Thank you very much for being with us at a time when so many queries have been raised. But thank you very much, sir, for sharing those answers with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very
welcome. Indeed. Thank you so much.
Twitter has lost its legal protection in India from prosecution over users' posts because of its failure to comply with new digital rules. This is what government sources are saying, as a case was also filed in UP against Twitter over tweets that the police say attempted to incite communal trouble. There were journalists and political leaders who have also been named over here. Are we essentially at the end of Twitter as we know it in this country? Will Twitter now be obliged to listen to everything that the government orders? Because if they aren't protected from action, then their freedom could be affected. On the other hand, has Twitter really followed or abided by local laws? It really depends who you ask. So this is what has happened today. They've lost their legal shield. They can now be charged for users' posts. Twitter is yet to comply with the digital rules that came into force on the 25th of May. Now, that's what the government keeps saying, that they haven't followed the rules. Therefore, they could be in trouble just like anybody else, any other publisher. due to their non-compliance, their protection as intermediary is gone. So it is this intermediary status which is protecting them thus far. Twitter can face liability for violating any Indian law. They've refused to comment so far, has Twitter, so we are waiting to hear from them. Ravi Shankar Prasad, the minister, says Twitter had multiple opportunities to comply but deliberately chose non-compliance. It's astounding that Twitter, which portrays itself as a flag bearer of free speech, chooses the path of deliberate defiance. Immunity from third-party content was guaranteed under Section 79 of the IT Act, but as an intermediary, Twitter could not be penalized for user posts. That is before. That's all changed. That's what this is all about now. But laws have changed, and Twitter did not comply with the provisions of the new IT rules. So the government has revoked Twitter's immunity. So essentially, that is what this is all about. Joining us now, Shama Mohammed, spokesperson of the Congress. Shama is one of the people who's actually been named in that FIR by the UP police for her tweet with regard to a particular case in Uttar Pradesh. Mishi Chaudhary, the technology lawyer with us. Thopali Srinivas, the BJP leader, joins us, as also Professor Kanchan Kaur, the assessor of Fact Check. Thank you all very much for being with us. Mishi Chaudhary, let me come to you first. Will there now be a scenario where Twitter will potentially kowtow to the government because there's nobody protecting them?
So let me clarify the legal position here. I think no matter the tweets or any kind of statements, neither the government nor the ministers or ministries decide the legal shield or the status of an intermediary. It is an exemption provision, which has always meant that when legally a case is filed against a user and a platform is also made a party, they go to court and they say that if there was a court order or if there was an actual reasoned order from a government, they told us that this content needs to be taken down and we took it down. We've done our job. We are not responsible for whatever this user may have done. So exempt us. That is what this legal shield or safe harbor or coverage or whatever you are talking about is laid down in law. Nobody just by saying, oh, yeah, today you are losing this status and they lose a status. It's not a registration. It's not a trademark. It is not a domain that Twitter forgot to renew and now they've lost that status.
Okay.
It's the courts who decide. It's not the police who decides. It's not the ministers who decides. Who decide about that. That's my first thing. So there's a lot of confusion.
Okay, I just wanted to go across to Professor Kanchan Kaur. I understand what Mishi is trying to say, but it doesn't work that way, does it? On the day that Twitter was told that, you know, you've lost this intermediary status, you're like any other publisher in this country, there is a case which is filed in Uttar Pradesh, Twitter is named on it. Therefore, isn't there some sort of clear messaging which is on? That you are now liable for what you put onto that, because if it's disagreeable, for whatever the reasons may be, then, you know, you're in trouble as well. Watch out.
Yes, sir, that's absolutely true. Actually, if you ask me, it was a bit foolish of Twitter not to have complied with the rules. They are the rules, and, well, we know that rules can be unreasonable at times, but as a business, the first thing you would do is comply with the rules and then take up any other battle that you might want to take up. So having said that, there's definitely a difference between a publisher and a platform. While at one point you could say the first is the speed at which things keep coming up on a platform, especially on the digital media. It's very, very difficult to control it. And it's just serving really as a platform for user-generated content.
Okay.
On the other hand, as publishers, you would have gatekeeping. You would be publishing what you have worked on and not what somebody else has worked on. And even if you are putting in external columns written by somebody else, you are still putting it through a process of gatekeeping. And therefore, the publisher could be held a lot more more liable in some ways. But with these social media platforms, then social media cannot function at all if you're going to have to say that every tweet, every little thing has to go through a certain amount of scrutiny.
And that's just the point. No one knows when that scrutiny starts. I think it depends on what exactly it is that you tweet. Shama Mohammed, the Congress leader, joins us. She's been named in that FIR today. Shama, do you intend to cut down on your tweeting? based on what has happened to you today?
Never. Never. I haven't done anything what other newspapers or publications have told that particular day. Your own channel reported it. PTI has reported it. Times Now has reported it. Indian Express has reported exactly what I've said. Why is there an FIR on me, and why is there not FIR on them? What is the reason is one question. So definitely, I'm not somebody who's going to fear these people. When the truth is out there, we have to speak. You have to understand Twitter are mediums where people come out and say the truth many times. And of course, there are fake newses. We all know that. Now, let's take the case of Siddhi Kappan, a journalist who wanted to do reporting by the normal norms, just like you. But what has happened on him? There is a UAPA on him. Why? That's the question we need to know. Now, what I read was Twitter loses its legal protection in India for flaring communal sentiments. Now, let me just read for you one tweet last year, which flared communal sentiments in New Delhi. Delhi police ko 3 din ka ultimatum. Jafarabad aur Chandbad ki sadke khali karwaiye. Iske baad hame pata hum mat hame samjhega.
Right. So this is what flared up and caused the riots. It is alleged in Northeast Delhi, right? And there was not that tweet was not taken down. That's what your point is.
No, what I'm saying is that last time also Twitter was showing videos saying goli maro desh ke gaddaro ko goli maro saalo ko. Why didn't you take action when Twitter showed those videos?
So let me take that question to Mr. Srinivas. So that's the real worry over here, Mr. Srinivas. That, you know, there's going to be this selective use of Twitter of taking down content if it suits your political purpose. So Shama's actually named a few examples on when there is this blind hate which has existed on Twitter, which doesn't get taken down. And then over here, for right or for wrong, people like her are named in an FIR. Twitter also gets an FIR.
Vishal, thank you so much for calling me here. And second time we are debating on the same topic. And glad that we are taking out a lot of topics here. If you have listened to the Honorable IT Minister's statements, he has been very categorically clear that things have not been followed since February onwards when the rule had been made. Now, when the Honorable Congress spokesperson is talking about one incident, I am talking about multiple incidents what Twitter has done.
In short,
hold on, please. Listen to me out. The Sultanate of Twitter has to listen to the Republic of India. This is my opening statement.
The what?
Because
the what of Twitter?
The Sultanate. Because it is behaving as a judge and a adjudicator.
Okay.
It is behaving in an independent manner.
Okay.
It's a metaphor. Sultanate of Twitter has to listen to the Republic of India. The reason is very simple. It is not about current aspect here. It has been a lot of multiple aberrations which have been there. For example, the geographical location of Ladakh shown in China.
Yeah,
you're talking about
that.
Hold on. I'm also coming to the second point.
They fixed it.
Now, Shamaji talked about Koli Maro Saloko. I'm talking about multiple content of hate being pushed from outside India during the farmers' agitation. Why did the Twitter not take out? It is a selective making and marking of a mistrust information.
But Mr. Srinivas, what is it that you want to take down? Anything that you dislike? Should Twitter
be taken down
because they made a mistake on a map on Ladakh, which they have changed, right?
Should Twitter be taken down because they refused to take off tweets?
Of people who have protested during the farmer protests. Is that reason enough?
See, you heard what happened
with dissent yesterday in the High Court, sir.
It's
our right.
I'm giving you one factual statement here. When the Delhi police had an interview with the so-called Twitter managing director, he said, I'm not whatsoever, I have role in the operations relating to the content. He's just a mere sales head. He gave a statement. That means Twitter has only a statutory shares.
Yeah, that's right. That is their structure. And I appreciate the need to have an intermediary in India. That's a separate point.
Yes.
But I think the question being raised over here is that what is this going to result in? It goes well beyond the appointment of a officer. That's not what we are discussing. Mishi, would you like to comment on this? What is the real issue over here?
The real issue here is
what you can say and what you cannot say. Right?
Yes.
Because if you say some stuff, you'll be frowned upon.
Yeah, first thing I want to say is that it is not the first time a case has been filed or an FIR has been registered with where one of these platforms is a party. There have been several such cases which have been filed a lot of times. And that is when these parties go to court and then they say this is wrongly, we have been wrongly implicated in this case. We also have a legal safe harbor provided to us. That's my first point. The second point is, these companies definitely require to be, there is definitely a requirement for regulation. There is definitely a requirement for more transparency as well as accountability about how decisions are being made. Now, one of the problems is that our own law, when government actually sends an order for content blocking or taking down of certain content or handles, requires confidentiality and secrecy. So right. We do have to understand that we have to change that part. The third, these companies, only last year in June, when Mr. Trump was on his way out of being in the presidency, started labeling this, that manipulated media or something else. Companies make their money by profiling us, by collecting a lot of data about us. So the more engagement happens on these platforms, they love it. However, we ourselves want them that, oh, there is a lot of disinformation and misinformation or something else, which child sexual abuse material. We want you to take down this. They would love to be just left alone and nobody tells them to take away anything and they are not liable. You and I can do whatever we want on their platforms. But because we want them to take down certain materials, that is why they are the ones who are forced to do it.
Okay.
Fourth, they don't want to be the adjudicator, judge, jury, or sultanate, or whatever. They don't want
right.
to be.
So it's a question of what actually the standards are. I need to start wrapping this up because I'm out of time.
The Supreme Court wants them to say that only... The Supreme Court also said only if you receive a court order or you receive
right.
a reasoned
order from
the government.
The point, and you mentioned this point earlier, and I need to wrap this up by saying that hopefully there will not be a random utilization of the law against Twitter and what people tweet. Just right, I'm completely out of time, I'm afraid. Okay, just 30 seconds. First to Shama, and then to Mr. Srinivas. Yes.
What I want to say today is that it has to be transparent. When an Amit Malviya says Delhi is in the grip of Islamic onslaught during the Delhi riots, no action was taken. They have to be transparent. Yes, if we want to work, if you want to attack Twitter, let it be transparent.
Okay.
Let it attack on
Mr. Srinivas, last word to you.
Or with somebody in the Congress party. And let me tell you, I am
no,
going
no,
to
one
be
second, Shama, there's a time issue over here. Mr. Srinivas, go ahead. Yeah.
I will
see. There are multiple statements across the board. Twitter has to regulate it, period. There should not be ifs and buts.
All right. There should not be ifs and buts. Twitter needs to start regulating. Hopefully that will be done done peacefully and hopefully that will be done fairly. I'd like to thank our panelists all very much for being with us. We're going to take a short break up. After that, a very special interview coming up with Dr. N.K. Arora, a key member of the COVID task force, on why there is new data which actually says that 61% of people with a single shot of Covishield are effectively protected on the basis of real-world data in India, which has now been collected. With new data from the United Kingdom suggesting that you do need two doses of vaccines to protect you from the Delta variant, that's the variant of COVID first discovered in India. Key questions remain on whether this should be done in India as well. For now, the government has said no. The dosing gap of Covishield is okay between 12 to 16 weeks, and the dosing gap of Covaxin remains unchanged. But is this all because of a shortage of vaccines, that whatever vaccines you have, you try and get people to have at least one dose, or because medically this is the correct gap? To answer this and several other questions, very happy to have with us this evening Dr. N.K. Arora, chairperson of the COVID Working Group. Thanks very much for being with us. So what is the science of deciding that the gap between Covishield doses shouldn't be brought back?
So in January, when we started with the National COVID Immunization Program, at that time, if you remember, we had an interval of 4 weeks.
Yeah.
And that was based on the bridging trial which we had done and which showed that at 4-week interval, the immune response is very good and comparable with the 4-week interval seen in the global trials. Although UK had even at that time increased the interval to 12 weeks. And that was the time that they were facing the challenge of alpha variant outbreak. And they were having a tough time in December, January, February. And that's what, so they had gone in for 12-week interval at that time. Along with even the Pfizer vaccine, they had gone in for 12 weeks, although the manufacturer told them to keep it at 3 weeks. 3 weeks, yes.
Right.
But we were not convinced and we went ahead with 4 weeks. 6 weeks later, WHO also came up and they suggested that 6 to 8 weeks may be a good idea. We reviewed the data and we had initial experience from UK and we thought that it may be worthwhile to increase it to 6 to 8 weeks. However, within the committee, we decided that we will look at the real life data coming from UK because yes. UK and India are the largest consumers of AstraZeneca vaccine or the Covishield, which we called in India. And in the later part of April, third week or fourth week, we had this Public Health England report
yes.
which suggested that with 12-week interval, the vaccine efficacy was varying between 65 to 88%. And this was a time, it was in May, early May, that we decided that, and we were, as you can understand, that was the worst period as far as Delta variant outbreak, ferocious outbreak was taking place in
but
India.
But isn't it correct, sir, that it's 33 point something percent efficacy
I will come to that.
Of AZ?
Yeah. So we took the decision on, I think, 6th or 13th May, and within 2 days, we learned that...
Yes, exactly.
Public Health England have looked at the data and they showed that with 1 week, with one dose, the protection is 33% and
correct.
With two doses, the protection is 60 weeks. The methodology is called test negative study design. And the number of individuals who had received AstraZeneca single dose and those who had received double dose was very little, 200 and then in few tens or 20s kind of a thing,
okay.
where this 33% was stemmed. However, and this it was not convincing enough, and therefore we continued with this decision. Here I must say that initially AstraZeneca vaccine was prepared as a single dose, and it was interesting to see that at 4 weeks the protection was 57%. At 8 weeks, the protection was 60%. At 12 weeks, it was 63%. And between 12 weeks and 44, it became 75% around that.
This is real-world data in India, sir?
No. This is the basic trial data from Mexico, South Africa, and England.
Right.
Yeah. So there is a scientific basis why adenovirus vaccines, when they increase the interval, the efficacy increases.
No, but sir, what about the argument that in the case of the Delta variant, which is more transmissible, we know that as a fact, you need
yes.
to have the second dose because it reduces the possibility of transmissibility.
Yes. So I'm coming to that because meanwhile, there were several studies when we were discussing it in our working group and then NTAGI and subsequently in the STSC group, we were privy to some of the data. And
right.
now this data has become public. There are
right.
two datas which are available in public domain, which have become available in last 10 days. One is from PGI Chandigarh, where Covishield has been given and they have done the study among health professionals. And with a single dose as well as with double dose, the vaccine efficacy is 75%. Now here the catch is that this is the data when Punjab and adjoining areas were facing the alpha
variant
outbreak. Yes. So that was till 16th April. It was only part of Delta variant, but bulk was alpha variant.
Yes.
But 2 days ago or 3 days ago, Vellore has done, CMC Vellore has come up with the data, which is primarily, which was done in the midst of this Delta surge, and which showed that if it is one dose, it is 61% vaccine effectiveness, and if it is two doses, it is 65% vaccine effectiveness.
What
in
was
our
the sample
setting.
Size, sir?
Sample size is several thousand. It is not hundreds.
So it's statistically relevant, is your
very
point?
Very relevant. Very relevant, and with narrow kind of uncertainty levels. So this has come up that even with Delta variant, when you do, and the other important point I think all of us have to understand, as of today, 26 crore plus injections have been given, doses have been given, out of which only about 4 or 5 crore have received two doses, remaining are 18 crores or so have received one dose. That is the ground reality here. Uh-huh. So what it is showing is that even those who have received one dose, at least in the short run, I'm underlining at least in the short run, the protection from serious disease, from hospitalization and death is similar whether you have received one dose or you have received two doses of Covishield, and same is true for Covaxin also.
Dr. Arora, are you excited about the prospect of Novavax coming into India? Where are you as far as trials of that in India are concerned? How soon do you think EUA can happen, and how many doses do you think can be produced?
So Novavax is very exciting, and as you're right, in the last 1 week it has created a rage because India is going to manufacture almost 1 billion doses a year. It's very simple. It is going to be much cheaper, and 90% plus vaccine effectiveness is there, and a very similar vaccine, Indian vaccine, is also under phase 3 trial. I'm sure you are aware of Bio-E vaccine. And we are promised 30 crore doses by the end of this year. They are very similar vaccines. So these two vaccines are really exciting in a sense. We have previous experience of similar platform. They are safe across the age groups and very high effectiveness.
So, sir, on the basis
and
of what you're
seeing,
it will
also take care of our
of children,
the vaccine requirement.
Potentially children as well. No, but sir. Yes. I know it's early to be asking this because, it's still none of these have been cleared for use in India as yet. But is there a possibility of either Bio-E or Novavax, which is going to be called Covovax here in India, becoming a single dose vaccine? Is there data to suggest high efficacy for a single dose?
I haven't seen that trial data, Novavax. Obviously, biological E data is still coming. They have just finished phase 1-2. And they're entering into...
And how efficacious is Bio-E's vaccine?
Bio-E vaccine, the initial data is as exciting as Novavax because it's a very similar kind of
vaccine. So an Indian vaccine with 90% efficacy, many a slip between cup and lip, but that said, you expect it to be 90% or so?
Yes, I feel that it could be around the same. And I must tell you, there are a couple of other Indian vaccines are also on the anvil.
The Zydus Cadila vaccine is very interesting.
Yeah, Cadila DNA vaccine. And then there is another Indian mRNA vaccine is going to be there. It is just entering phase 2, I think by next week, Monday or so. And by the end of September, we should have that our own mRNA vaccine, which is more compatible for Indian setting in terms of storage, in terms of transport, in terms of shelf life.
Sir, just to go back to Bio-E, and I know you don't deal with prices, but I think one of the most attractive elements of this Indian drug is what, 250 rupees for two doses. That's a world beater. That's far cheaper than even Covishield. So obviously we have our own requirements, but ultimately if this is flooded to other parts of the world, then the potential is incredible.
I must tell you, this may look presumptuous statement, but ultimately the world will be dependent on us for COVID vaccine. It is very premature. It is very presumptuous. But as soon as our requirement is fulfilled, I think we can look after the world. I co-chair the COVAX facility on the other side in WHO also.
Yeah.
And I'm aware that everybody is looking forward to India because most of the poor countries and low-income countries and low- and middle-income countries have no source. yesterday only we had a discussion which is going to come up, and again it is going to be a similar Novavax like vaccine. It is likely to be, so they have already done phase one study. So we are really looking forward to a lot of these exciting areas.
So where is BioE in terms of trials and trials being completed?
I think they are just starting there. They finished phase one. They will be starting phase two.
No, I'm talking about the BioE one, which is very similar to Novavax.
That's what I'm saying, BioE. Okay. They have finished phase one.
Okay.
And they are in the process of starting phase two and then going for phase three.
So how long would that take?
September or October. By October, I think they should finish their studies, because now the sample size is not huge. The comparator is, because of the various reasons, you have to use a smaller sample size, and such large sample sizes are not required.
So there's still some time, for that to happen. So Novavax will be there earlier, hopefully.
I hope so, because Novavax is facing another difficulty of its own kind, because US FDA has denied them giving emergency use because they no longer have emergency. So they are waiting for, they have to go through the full drill. But if they have to come to India, they will have to do at least a bridging trial here, unless they get some approval from EMA, MHRA, or WHO.